Mark Morano is unleashed, and he's taking on the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, breaking news. This time, they really, really mean it. The United Nations is warning the world. World is on the edge of a climate abyss. The stakes could not be higher. All those are in quotes. According to the UK Guardian, top UN experts declare leaders must act radically to save the planet. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Earth is serially doomed. This is actual story. They're still at it. This is actually, this is just dated Friday, May 9th, 2024. They can't stop predicting doom and deadlines and telling us we can legislate ourselves out of the Earth climate catastrophe. We must, our political leaders, your elected leaders or your unelected leaders, must act radically or the climate will get you. You've got to pay up. You've got to ration food. You've got to ration your freedom of movement. You've got to ration energy, or else the climate will get you. And we need to, this is a crisis. We're in emergency management mode. We have to give up liberties and freedoms and freedom of movement because the Earth is facing a climate abyss. Do you understand that? Give in, submit, obey. That's our only option. This is the world in which we live. Sorry, I had to self-censor myself. Anyway, all right, that's what the UN's up to. All right, and segueing from that, this is the anxiety over Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This is a clip of his. I believe it's 2019. It might be 2020, but it's either late 2019 or early 2020. Talking about the Green New Deal and AOC, and this is gives me anxiety. I don't think he holds these views today, but geez, this wasn't that long ago. But let's take a look. RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now running for president. The man who says he won't talk about climate change. It's been hijacked for totalitarian control, which is all true. But here he is, pre-COVID, during AOC's ballyhoo over the Green New Deal, clip one.
Oh, you know, that all of the modeling for climate change indicates that we're going to be facing superstorms, storms on steroids, droughts, you know, famine, the disappearance of the ice caps, the disappearance of the glaciers on every continent, and that it's going to be, you know, there's going to be major disruptions, not just to humanity, but ultimately to civilization. And this is part of the cost that we're paying for our long-time deadly addiction to coal and oil endorsement.
What about AOC's new Green Deal? What do you think about that?
I think the Green New Deal is, you know, all of that stuff is important, it's good, we ought to be pursuing it.
I don't, that's all the clip I could find. I could not find his further continuance of that, but you know, he doesn't actually, if you dissect it, he's certainly not an organizer. He's not a proponent. It sort of sounds good. He hasn't really investigated. Oh, I think that sounds good. But it just goes to show you that he was deeply a man of that political left only just right before COVID. And even I found tweets of his late May 2020. Remember, the lockdowns began third week in March or so, flattened the curve. 2 months after that, he's still chastising, I think it was Facebook, for allowing climate misinformation. So he's still pushing censorship. So somewhere between May of 2020 and the end of summer, the next couple months, he had some kind of radical transformation. Maybe he was horrified at what he saw. Maybe he would not have had that red pilling on a lot of these issues if the lockdowns had only lasted 10 days to flatten the curve, you know, as they say, as they promised. So I don't know. It's fascinating. It's worth considering, but I think he's pretty much renounced that. I don't think he supports. Even Naomi Wolf, who I actually had on this program, talked openly about the Green New Deal as fascism. She was concerned about climate as a progressive liberal, but she recognizes fascism when she sees it. The Green New Deal is fascism. That's what she said, her quotes. Okay. Roseanne Barr. Roseanne Barr from the TV show. She was fired by ABC. Very upset, by the way. She created that character. She made the network billions of dollars, probably in the end, or hundreds of millions, whatever it was. And they killed her off without her consent because she did the one Valerie Jarrett's Planet of the Apes tweet. And she is now very upset, and she's talking about the working class, how out of touch her liberal friends are, and talking about the exit from ABC News. Let's watch a little bit of Roseanne Barr talking, clip two.
So now what we have is the money to build a phenomenal supercomputer that is going to be accessible to researchers in New York, college students, and I want others to follow, because right now we have, you know, young black kids growing up in the Bronx who don't even know what the word a computer is. They don't know. They don't know these things. And I want the world open up to all of them.
Are you kidding me?
Not sure what that clip was, but it was not Roseanne Barr. I'm not sure if we have Roseanne Barr. It's a good clip, but I will find it. We'll get back to you on that. Let's go to clip three. Glenn Greenwald debating Ilya Shapiro on the campus crackdowns. Now, I really am an absolutist on free speech. Hell, I think you can even shout fire in a crowded theater. No, I don't think you should be able to do personally disrupt just for the sake of disrupting, and you should be penalized if you do cry fire. But I don't like much of the right. I told you I would have been one of those 20 congressmen who voted against the, you know, anti-Semitism bill and the speech codes, which they're hate speech that Republicans are now legislating, which they campaigned against for years. Glenn Greenwald debating Ilya Shapiro. This is their debate. This is his comments on the campus crackdowns and what's going on. Clip three.
You are now liable to being accused of a felony for the expression of your political views that somehow align with the interests of a terrorist group, like, hey, we should leave the Middle East, or saying we should leave Ukraine, and that somehow is deemed pro-Russian speech. I can't think of a graver assault on the right of free speech than criminalizing political activism of that sort.
That's nonsense, and you're being disingenuous and leveling those kinds of accusations.
There's a difference between giving a speech saying Israel is being illegitimate, they're engaged in genocide, this is all wrong, this is bad, we shouldn't support them, and chanting from the river to the sea, Israel should be gone, kill all the Jews, any Jew you see today, punch them in the face.
No one claimed those groups were doing that.
I believe we should have this debate, Glenn Greenwald. I generally agree with, particularly on free speech issues like this. I'm just worried that we get caught up. Now, if they're vandalizing property at these universities and they're holding out, I mean, you got to weigh that. And I'm not arguing that, you know, they shouldn't be cracking down and clearing out these protests. It's been enough. What I'm most concerned about is, and it happened early on in the campus protests, just because someone writes a pro-Hamas declaration doesn't mean, you know, we as conservatives should gleefully be naming them and hoping they never get hired by anyone. I mean, that's kind of penalizing someone for a youthful error in judgment, if you want to call it that. But either way, it's their right of what they believe in. And I just so worried about the speech code crackdown and this whole propensity to just you know, fall into this, you know, they can't say that. That's outrageous. Everything they're saying is a threat. I don't buy it. I'm sorry. I'm not on this bandwagon. And I do support Glenn Greenwald fighting this and pointing out the hypocrisy, particularly of Republicans who for years talked against speech codes and now seem to be all for them. All right. Well, there's a new Trump in town. Barron Trump, the very tall son of Donald Trump, which I'm not sure how old he is. He might be 17 now, 16, 17. I don't think he's quite 18. He is going to join the Florida delegation to the GOP National Convention, and he's thinking of a future in politics. Wow. How could you look at what your dad's gone through and say, hey, I'd like to do that too. That sounds like fun. I don't know. He must be, you know, must be very strong character. Let's watch clip four, Barron Trump, the son of Donald Trump, youngest son of Donald Trump, might be entering politics.
The Republican Party of Florida has chosen a high school senior to serve as an at-large delegate at the party's national convention this summer. And get ready, because you know this name, Barron Trump. The youngest son of the former president just turned 18 back in March. He graduates from high school next week, in fact. He joins three of Trump's other kids, Don Jr., Eric, and Tiffany, in that Florida delegation to the convention, which will take place in Milwaukee in July. So the youngest Trump child stepping into politics now as well.
Wow. I generally don't like presidents' families running. I didn't. Jeb Bush, forget it. Again, I liked Jeb Bush at one moment. George W. Bush, son of H.W. I mean, come on, just goodbye. Thank God the Clintons only have Bill and Hillary. I don't think the daughter's ever going to run for anything. Reagan's kids, thankfully, stayed out of politics in terms of electoral politics. Who else do we have? The Bushes, Obama, thank God, there's rumors Michelle might run. But hopefully that legacy building thing doesn't continue. Even the Kennedys, RFK, you know, there's a soft spot only for the Kennedys because it was assassinated and cut short. So it's almost like, okay, you get a pass. You can have another family member run. Then he's cut short and died. Then, of course, you have Ted Kennedy, who just, you know, was pretty much, I consider a disastrous legacy of just bloated spending and liberalism and, you know, just being the establishment. So RFK, I have no problem with. Again, I guess it's because this is a weird thing to say on live TV, but I guess it's because I give the Kennedy legacy a pass because so many of them, two of the top ones have been literally gunned down, shot down. So it's almost like they never got to finish. So it's family members continuing on. That I can accept. What I can't accept is the Bushes, who George H.W. Bush roundly rejected in 1992, and I didn't vote for George H.W. Bush. I didn't vote for Bill Clinton. I didn't vote for Ross Perot. I voted for Andre Mourou, who was the Libertarian candidate in 1992. I hope I'm right about that. I don't think it was 96. It could have been. I think I voted for Pat Buchanan in 96. Very hard for me to remember, but I never wasted my vote, and it is wasting your vote on the main party nominee. I said my exception, I didn't vote for George W. Bush in 2000. I did vote for George W. Bush in 2004 only because I hated John Kerry and I got caught up in that, but I regret that vote. I did vote for John McCain only because I liked Sarah Palin at the time and I regret that vote. I did not vote for Mitt Romney, did not, and of course I did vote for Donald Trump twice. Anyway, sorry, I don't think you care about who I voted for, but it's important distinction just to point that out, that I don't, this is not a good development to me that Barron Trump is getting involved in politics. Just stay out, stay out. Now, you can get involved in politics. I don't mind, you know, Michael Reagan did a great conservative talk show for years and years. I was actually a regular on his old show. I don't have any problem with that. I just, don't run for office. Don't use your parents' legacy. And again, I feel weird saying it, but the Kennedys don't bother me as much only because they were cut short. They're too top. They just never had a chance. I don't think they ever got to complete it other than Edward Kennedy. And there's a lot of lesser Kennedys. What I mean by lesser is lower office Kennedys, House congressmen and things like that, and state officials. Anyway, all right. I'm turning into gibberish here. Pierre Poilievre, running the chief opposition to Justin Trudeau in Canada, is a great dispute back and forth about the carbon tax that Justin Trudeau is pushing in Canada. And there's an important point I want to make about these carbon taxes. When you watch this and you'll see Justin Trudeau, they put on this big onerous tax on energy. It raises the cost. It causes inflation. It causes just shortages and rationing, and it suppresses development. And you know how they sell the poor and middle class on it? Well, government's going to rebate you. So yeah, your goods and services will cost more, but we're going to give you money. Do you realize what horseshit that is from beginning to end? The government comes in, Fs up the market, and then you know it, you can see it firsthand, cost of food, energy, everything goes up. Inflation through the roof, rationing. It's all for bullshit, by the way. You're not fighting climate change. You're not lowering global emissions. You're just offshoring your energy to countries with much lower environmental and human rights standards. So it's In fact, these kind of carbon taxes in the West lead to more emissions than you would otherwise have had the stupid West with the best technology and the best standards and the best human rights had done the energy extraction themselves. No, let's put a carbon tax on and suppress it so that other nations can make up for it. But then they come up with this rebate horseshit, and that's horseshit from beginning to end, because they're raising the cost intentionally, and then they're going to pay you to basically take it and accept it, and government's going to give you a check. And it's a way they can buy votes, because you're going to want to vote for those politicians handing you checks. We had a similar thing during Obama's cap and trade debate when I was working in the U.S. Senate Environment Public Works Committee. It would have been 2006, 7, 8, 9. I was there for 2006, 7, 8, 9. They literally came up with a low income, housing and assistance program. It was called LIHEAP, was an acronym. And the idea was, yeah, we're going to have a carbon tax version, cap and trade, and we're going to raise your energy. But hey, don't worry. The government is going to give you direct payments to make up for it. Aren't we wonderful? We're saving the planet. We're stopping climate change. And we're giving you a big fat check every year. And that's what Justin Trudeau is trying to do. Anyway, here they are again. My problem with Pierre Poilievre, the chief opposition, he accepts climate. He's like a European conservative. He accepts there's a climate problem and we need solutions. And he's all in on planting trees and capturing carbon. In other words, he's full of shit. I'd have trouble voting for Pierre Poilievre just on that. It just bugs the shit. Obviously, he's better than Justin Trudeau, but he's taken that European playbook. And what's happening in the U.S., many youth conservative so-called groups want Republicans to embrace the climate crisis and come up with conservative solutions, that we shouldn't challenge the premise. The UN is right and Greta is right on the science. Oh, they might be a little alarmist, but we need to come up with solutions. We can't lose the young people who've been indoctrinated. Sorry, let's move on. Justin Trudeau on his carbon tax, and Pierre Poilievre responds. Clip 5.
According to the Parliamentary Budget Office, 8 out of 10 Canadians, middle-income and lower-income Canadians primarily, do better with the Canada Carbon Rebate.
Oh, we have to do this all over again with him. The Parliamentary Budget Officer produced a report. I'm going to read the title so that he can Google it right now, Mr. Speaker. It is called The Parliamentary Budget Officer's Report on the Distribution of Costs and Benefits Under the Carbon Pricing Program. He can look at page 3, where every single province that has the tax sees middle-class Canadians and 60% of families paying more in tax than they get back in benefits. Why won't he get to know the facts and axe the tax?
At least he's fighting the policies of Justin Trudeau up in Canada. And he's a gifted politician, Pierre Poilievre. I'm butchering his name, I know. I want to root for him all the way, but I have just such problems with that. And I've had multiple UK, European, talk to Peter Sweden about this. Why are Europeans generally, at least in countries like Germany and England, so weak when it comes to attacking the premise of the climate crisis? Many great members of parliament in the EU. Roger Helmer is the one that invited me over to premiere my film at the EU headquarters in Brussels. He's now retired, but there's many like him, and I met many. And what's funny is they all seem to be from Czech Republic, Poland, Eastern Bloc nations. And I don't wonder, the reason that is, they don't all seem to be, but there's a more preponderance of the climate skeptics who are willing to challenge it from those countries, because they've seen tyranny and their countries have lived through tyranny for 40 plus years under Soviet domination, and they're not willing to accept the climate tyranny that's being imposed. All right, final two clips. This is just fascinating. I was looking at this and I just thought I had to show this. Terrifying. This is dash cam footage of a tornado in Lincoln, Nebraska, about 72 hours ago from this broadcast. It would have been about May 10th, 2024. And you can just see the destruction. Let's watch this is part one, but clip 6 of the tornado come in and decimate what looks like a safe structure to be in case there's a tornado. It looks like a giant warehouse. Clip 6.
Thank you.
Wow. I don't, that's called the finger of God. Wherever that tornado touches down, just like a magic eraser, just gone. I don't know. I couldn't find out if that was considered an F3, F4 tornado. I would say it's at least an F3. I just can't imagine that being an F2. Or there's the rating scale, the higher, the more devastating the tornado. This is clip, the final clip. It's slow motion of that building just being bye-bye from this tornado. Terrifying. Let's watch clip 7, and then I'm going to make a comment about how climate, they use this to scare people, which people should be afraid of tornadoes, but they're trying to say that our SUVs are making tornadoes worse. Clip 7. And this is what looks to be an F3 or bigger tornado in Lincoln, Nebraska. You can see this giant warehouse. It looks like it's cement sides, hard to tell. The roof comes off and then the debris goes. And then when the debris clears, there's nothing left. There's no building, there's nothing. The finger of God has spoken. Fascinating. I just show you that because the terrifying power of nature, it is awesome. I've seen like funnel clouds far away. I live in Virginia, so we do have tornadoes, but never the big ones like you see out in Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, the plains, the tornado alley. I'm not in it. But you get that green sky. But this is one of the things Al Gore, many others have tried to scare us about, the tornadoes. And the thing is, if you look at tornadoes in the United States, down big tornadoes, F3 larger, down dramatically since the 1950s, or at least declining trend. And we had the longest, you know, there's been incredible periods, like the longest period without F4, F5, the most catastrophic tornadoes. We've had some of the fewest. There is just no trends to support that our emissions of CO2 are making tornadoes worse. Sorry, not happening. In the U.S., I can't remember the number, like 80% of all tornadoes worldwide, for whatever reason, tornadoes like the U.S. Very fascinating. All right. When we come back, we are going to be joined by geologist Gregory Wrightstone, the director of the CO2 Coalition and the author of the very new book, A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Gregory Wrightstone.
TNT's David Curtin.
The Israeli Defense Force started bombing Rafah. Now, if you don't know, Rafah is the city at the bottom southern end of the Gaza Strip. It only takes up about 20% of the territory of Gaza, which was already well overpopulated and overcrowded before the Israeli Defense Force started its attacks on Gaza. They continually move people further south and further south and further south, and they have been doing that over the last 7 months until now. As well as the existing population of Rafah, there are 1.4 million refugees from other parts of Gaza, many of whom were already refugees themselves, and they've been moved into the southern 20% of the Gaza Strip in Rafah, which Israel said would be safe.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Need a ride?
Yeah!
Driving with kids is a big responsibility.
Hop in and buckle up!
So don't sweat the small stuff.
You got paint all over our paper!
Get the big stuff right instead.
What does that mean?
Like making sure your kids are in the correct car seat and buckled up for safer travel.
That deserves a wiggly wiggly wig.
To make sure your child is in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Beep, beep. Yeah!
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies. Because when people are fed, futures are nourished. Everyone deserves to live a full life. And with your help, together we can end hunger. Join the movement at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Without CO2, the world stops breathing. CO2 sustains all life on Earth. Government, the WEF, and the elite believe humans are the carbon they really want to be rid of. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining us now is geologist Dr. Gregory Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition, the chairman, executive director of that. Thank you for joining the program. He's also the author of A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Can Benefit Humanity. Thanks for coming on the program today, Greg.
Yeah, good to be back on with you again, Mark. It's always do such a good job here with the show.
All right, well, let's start with breaking news. The United Nations, according to the UK Guardian, and this article is just dated a couple days ago, May 9th, 2024. I put here, this time they really, really mean it. The UN is warning, Gregory Wrightstone, that the world is on the edge of a climate abyss, in quotes, and the stakes could not be higher. Top UN climate experts declare, quote, leaders must act radically, unquote. What is your response? Let's reverse the question. If we were actually facing this climate emergency, would our politicians acting radically somehow prevent that climate catastrophe?
No. We've seen now 40 years, 30 years of one prediction failure after another. The fact of the matter is that they like summer because summer is the best time of year to be a climate alarmist with tornadoes, hurricanes. In a few months, it'll be fires. And they do this and foment a climate of fear in order to have your viewers submit to their control strategy, trying to control every aspect of their lives.
So, but they just keep coming at us because it seems like the whole climate movement is they need fear in order to get people to go along with it. Let me ask you this. We have a whole coalition. It's been around for a while of these young, I would call them, they call themselves young conservatives. I'm not convinced how conservative they are, but they claim, you know, that the young people, people like Benji Backer, is leading organization, but they claim that young people are all concerned about climate and that the Republican Party is not addressing climate and the Republican Party will lose those votes. What they are seeking is the Republican Party to copy what's happening in Europe. And what's happening in Europe is the politicians accept the climate crisis and they agree on the premise and they all want to have solutions. They don't want to challenge any of the narrative of this, the science. Do you think that's a good idea to happen here in the U.S. in general? Few politicians go ahead. What do you think of that strategy?
Benji Backer, there's a series of these that should be they're kind of erstwhile allies. We have Benji promoting conservative climate solutions. People like Bjorn Lomborg or Michael Schellenberger, they're doing good work, but they start with a failed premise. Their premise is, there's a crisis and a problem that needs fixed. I don't give them an inch on that. There is no climate crisis. And they say, for example, Benji, he doesn't want to spend $3.5 trillion to solve the climate crisis. He just wants to spend $850 billion and do it wisely. I say, Benji, man, you got it wrong. Not one red cent, not one penny should be spent to solve this non-existent crisis. And because in my new book, A Very Convenient Warming, I go further than there is no climate crisis. We catalog and identify using science, facts, and data how our ecosystems are thriving and prospering tremendously. It's not by a little, it's by a lot, are benefiting, and the human condition and humanity is benefiting from modest warming and more CO2. It's, Mark, I call this the greatest untold story of the 21st century, that of a thriving Earth and benefits to humanity. Probably the greatest thing we can look at here is a crop productivity that are breaking records year after year after year. And you can look at the top eight crops in the world. I took a look at them in my book and found that they're breaking records from the warmest nations to the coldest nations year after year. Even the hot countries like India have crop growth records being broken. And so we're actually increasing food production faster than global population is expanding. And that's a good thing. We should celebrate how corn, soybeans, wheat, the other large crops in the world are expanding to feed that growing population. And it's because of warming, more CO2, and the use of nitrogen fertilizer that's derived from fossil fuels.
Yet if our viewers watch the mainstream media or listen to the United Nations, who, by the way, the UN spokesman actually says, we own the science on climate change, so we partnered with Google to make sure everyone knew it. In other words, they suppress any non-UN-supported climate message. But essentially, the UN is still warning, climate activists are warning, John Kerry's warning, that unchecked climate change will lead to collapse of our food supply. But oddly, the climate agenda is going after nitrogen fertilizer and methane, which would essentially ration high-yield agriculture and ration meat eating. So is it the climate agenda that's the threat to food production, or is it climate change driven by our CO2? How do they have that? How do they reverse it? Yes. How are they saying that climate is going to collapse our food supply?
What they're talking about doing, they want to decrease CO2 instead of increase it. Here at the CO2 Coalition, we're huge proponents, as you know, of the many benefits of climate, of CO2, increasing CO2. And they're just not willing to, they don't have the science, the facts and data on their side. We do. But they need to silence people like you and me and my fellow colleagues and scientists at the CO2 Coalition, because we tell a compelling story, and it's an interesting fact-based story. And I'm going to push back a little bit on you, Mark. I'm very optimistic. And as I travel around just meeting random people, I travel a lot. You travel a lot. I'm sure you're riding in an Uber here and there and everywhere.
Yes.
And I use Uber drivers. It used to be the taxi drivers, but now it's Uber drivers. It's a pretty good cross-section of America. And it is. Almost to a T. Of course, I can't help myself. I have to start preaching to the Uber driver as we're riding. And to a person, they're just fascinated and thirsty for the truth, for the information we're providing to tell them and comfort them and their children and their grandchildren that there is no climate crisis. And that's the story that we like to use. In fact, we did focus group effort last year, and that's the takeaway we had from the focus groups, where the people respond to a positive message. And that's what we do, sticking to the science and staying away from the politics. I'll leave that part up to you because you're so good at it. But we stick to the science, and we're proud to promote the truth of what's going on. Again, I'm hugely optimistic that so many people here in America are thirsty for this information. Now, Mark, I'll be leaving in 3 weeks. My new book's being published in Dutch. I'll be doing it'll be European, mainly Netherlands book tour. I'll be attending there with Clintel annual meeting, and we'll be pushing my book and doing interviews and presentations all over the Netherlands. And it's this kind of information we need to get out. This is a global problem, and it's one that we need to get the information, the truth on.
Well, speaking of that politics angle, in Europe, the politicians, and I've read that there's a thing called the UK Fires Report, came out 2019. It's calling for like 80% reduction in meat eating, closures of new airports, regulating CO2 as is similar to asbestos. I read the House of Lords transcripts of that, the political side of this, and not a single member of the House of Lords in the UK challenged the premise. And they all basically said, well, it went a little too far, but of course, climate's a problem. How do we translate And I think you're right. Here's where I think we disagree. You're definitely more optimistic than me, but I agree with you that the public is, I mean, major polling last week showed that this 10% drop in people concerned about climate change in just a couple of years. So your work is having a huge impact. I agree with you. But when it comes to the politics, it's not, doesn't seem to be trickling, because all throughout Europe, Canada, I was just talking about the main opposition to Justin Trudeau. They all accept there's a climate crisis and that we need solutions just like Benji. How do we translate your message of the science? You're doing a great job with people, but how do we get politicians, more and more politicians, to stand up and reframe that narrative?
Well, you know, we're using, that's a tough nut to crack, Mark. It's how do we do that? What we're doing here at the CO2 Coalition, we're doing state-specific and region-specific reports on climate change. And we can just point to Wyoming as one example where we created a report on Wyoming and its climate. And we saw that the title was Wyoming and Climate Change. Carbon dioxide should be celebrated, not captured, because the Republican governor of Wyoming is pushing... He wants to take the West. He wants to make it negative net zero. He wants to decarbonize the West. And just think about that. Doug Burgum from North Dakota, Kristi Noem from South Dakota, and they've all signed on to this nonsense. And I think what we've done in Wyoming, we went out and testified before the Senate. And a week after we came back, we had a team of scientists, Dr. Happer, Dr. Sapoyan, and myself went out there. And a week later, that same Senate voted to strip $257 million out of the Governor Gordon's Green Energy Fund. And they credited the work that we did there in the report, the reports and the science. And what we saw was in Wyoming, like in many areas around the United States, we saw that the heat waves and maximum temperatures peaked 90 years ago during the 1930s. And in Wyoming, we saw that percentages of days above 100 degrees has been falling for 80 and 90 years, not increasing. They claimed that we'd see the end of snow and the ski resorts were going to disappear. We looked at eight different ski resorts to find that six of the eight were increasing in snowfall and inches per year over the last 30 years. And we see things, we can look at that. They're predicting that wildlife would be disappearing and going extinct or endangered. And we took a look at the wildlife across Wyoming to find that each one of these mammals they're predicting terrible things for is actually increasing. And so what we find looking around at each one of these messages, again, ecosystems, endangered species, they're all doing better, not worse. But that doesn't, they need to spread this and create this climate of fear. So people will gladly, if there is an existential threat to the Earth, well, of course we should do something about it. We just don't see that being supported with the science.
Well, you know, and what you're doing is where the rubber meets the road, because you're influencing directly politicians in charge of this climate policy. And I love that. I love to hear that, especially when you present the science at a key moment and it actually has legislative results. That's impressive. So the question then, going back to the youth movement, how do we get this message? Because one of the things driving the idea of we have to have accept this and come up with solutions is this idea that young people believe it and people are going to lose their votes, and politicians are susceptible. Oh, I need to worry about that. I can't be a climate denier. How do we educate the young people? How do we deprogram propaganda from elementary school through college on climate?
We're trying here at the CO2 Coalition. We've got an education initiative where we've created books, comic books, and lesson plans, or videos. And each one of these has a lesson plan to go with it. We're actually getting these into some of the public schools, particularly in Texas. We've had two systems reach out for us. They love that our lesson plans are created by scientists, Dr. Sharon Camp, AP science reader, AP science teacher. So we take painstaking detail to make sure that the lesson plans we provide are quality. We'll be traveling to Florida next week to go to the Florida Parent Teacher Conference. It's the largest homeschool conference in the world, actually. We'll be there with a double booth presenting our materials. including these comic books that we've got. We've got a talented artist down in Brazil that works full-time for us. Just wonderful, captivating artwork that are in these books. The kids just love it. And we've seen people just, we just shipped a whole shipment to a large charter school in Oregon. And they loved our material. So we're getting it out there. It's a tough road to hoe getting this into the public schools, but we're starting to be successful. And we just really rolled this out less than a year ago. It's at the co2learningcenter.com is to get the information there. And I've got a new book, a children's book that I just wrote. It's called Chloe the Clownfish Sleeps Well at Night. And so we're able to take a clownfish that lives on the Great Barrier Reef and say, she's scared. She went to school and learned that her reef was going to be destroyed. And we use this as a vehicle then to bring in the science. I recruited Dr. Peter Ridd, one of the top reef experts in the world. He and I worked together on this to get the science right about what's actually happening to Chloe and the other animals that live on the Great Barrier Reef. And we find the Great Barrier Reef isn't being destroyed. It's actually thriving and prospering, completely opposite of what we've been told.
All right, we're talking with Gregory Wrightstone, the executive director of the CO2 Coalition, author of A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. We'd take a break. We'll be right back with more of Gregory Wrightstone after these messages. Stay tuned.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses, but there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
The mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind. We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride, but there's also a significant amount of pressure.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
Watching the sun come up, that's my time. I can have a cup of coffee, and every day is a new opportunity.
That's cool.
Your hands got so cool.
Yay!
Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
From wars to censorship to cultural issues, you're with Mark Morano and Unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with Gregory Wrightstone, the executive director of the CO2 Coalition, author of A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. All right. We have right now we're in a presidential year. And it looks like polling for climate is not going well for the Democrats. But Joe Biden is strongly considering declaring a national climate emergency, which would give him wartime powers. Center for Biological Diversity says it gives him 130 executive wartime powers by which to bypass democracy. He'll be able to, you know, we have the German transport minister 3 weeks ago floating the idea of a weekend car ban travel in order to meet their net zero goals. You're on the front lines of this. You're fighting on the science. You're talking to state legislators, politicians. You're touring Europe. How do we fight this idea of the climate emergency? And let's reverse the question. Is there, if we did face one, is there anything politicians could do to stop it? You'll forget about what would have theoretically caused it or whether we have one. Is there a way? I don't even know what they want us to do. They essentially say if you shut down free enterprise, that somehow the climate will benefit and we can prevent an emergency. We need more central planning. Where does this come from? I mean, how do they even get away with this? Yeah, on the ground, what are you finding?
Yeah, we take a look when we go into these states. we take a look, actually, what would happen? How much warming would be averted if they did go to net zero? Yes. And we find that it's actually in the thousandths of a degree Fahrenheit of temperature warming that would be averted. It's an incredibly small amount. And it's amazing hubris for people to think that that CO2 is the control knob of the temperature of the atmosphere, and we control the CO2. But in fact, that's just not the case. We need to advance this idea of the huge benefits of warming and more CO2.
Well, you have people like NASA's lead scientist Gavin Schmidt, who says that anyone basically that if climate skeptics, what was the phrase he used, that they were sociopaths. So you have the top global warming scientist at NASA. I don't say top. I mean, the guy in charge, not necessarily he's got the best credentials because he doesn't. But essentially, why all the name calling? Why the demonization? Why do they call us climate deniers? You had the CBS, Scott Pelley said he won't interview a climate denier for CBS News for the same reason he won't interview a Holocaust denier. What is going on? Why are they so threatened by you and your scientific presentation?
Because if I showed them the facts, the science, the data that shows the deserts are shrinking, that forests, we're not experiencing deforestation, we're experiencing reforestation. We can go through, we can march through this entire litany of heat wave increases. No, we can march through their litany that rising temperatures, we're going to kill millions of people. Just the opposite is occurring. We have 15 to 20 times as many people die from cold as from heat. What does that tell me? It tells me that global warming saves lives, because we would save millions of people an early, untimely death from cold-related issues. And it's they're warning us, too, of a 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. And that's from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Well, guess what? It's already warmed 1.2 degrees. So what they're really warning us about is 3/10 of a degree Celsius, half a degree Fahrenheit. We can't let it get that warm or it's all over. Well, it's probably warmed up or cooled down in your studio just as we started talking more than that. And if you're that worried about it, move 19 miles, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, move 19 miles further north and your average temperature will be reduced by half a degree Fahrenheit. When you think, if we're able to get out there and tell people this information, about how corn is a great example, it has just been exploding across. This is the greatest crop, biggest crop in the world. It's breaking records year after year. It's a tremendous story. We can tell the story of sea level rise that's increasing. I hope you are sitting down good, because it's increasing at 7 inches per century. It's not accelerating. We can look at the Maldive Islands to find out that they're just above sea level, the most at-risk island nation chain in the world. And 15,000 years ago, the Maldives were also just above sea level. But since that time, sea level has risen 400 feet. Why are the Maldives and the other islands not under 400 feet of water? It's because of a geologic process known as accretion. And so what they're warning us about is within the next several decades, the Maldives will be underwater. Well, you know what? That's about 2.5 inches of sea level rise. So the last 400 feet of sea level rise didn't put them underwater. But that next 3 inches, look out. Well, heck, that's barely above your ankles. Man, it might not even be above your ankles. And they're warning. I think they're actually their own worst enemy, because everything unusual, unprecedented, something strange, lots of rain, too much snow, not enough snow. They attribute it to man-made climate change. And I think people are wise to it. They've seen these instances of linking climate change to increased toenail fungus, for crying out loud. They link it to everything is now back and attributed to climate change. As if this has never happened before. We see, too, that the fires are 20% of what they were 90 years ago. It's not, we're seeing a decrease in both number and area burned of fires, hurricanes. Even the UN's Intergovernmental panel on climate change agrees that there's no documented increase in hurricanes. And I think you and I can agree that we would argue, I think, that there's been a slight decrease in hurricane activity. But what they do is that this is the trick they use for hurricanes. It is true. They'll claim that there's been an increase in named hurricanes. Yep, there sure has. They're naming the hurricanes earlier. Well, it used to be a tropical depression, now gets a name, so they can claim and be truthful that named hurricanes are increasing. Well, if you start naming them early when there's just a tropical depression, you're going to get more named hurricanes.
And isn't that true of tornadoes? Doesn't Al Gore say we've never counted this many tornadoes? But isn't that because of better technology to be able to count them, what we would have missed in earlier decades?
It is. Tornadoes and hurricanes are both difficult. I mean, hurricanes for long range analysis, going back to 1850, say, it's difficult because a lot of these hurricanes rose up in the Atlantic or typhoons in the Pacific and dissipated and no one knew about it. So I like using landfalling hurricanes in the United States here, because if a hurricane makes landfall from the mid-1800s on, you're going to know it. It's hard to avoid not knowing when a hurricane makes landfall. So we know every single hurricane has made landfall, and it's been in decline. And same with tornadoes. Before Doppler radar came into being and the stations were set up, there were a lot of tornadoes that touched down in the middle of nowhere, of Podunk, Iowa, or Kansas, and no one knew about it. But now with Doppler radar, we can measure those. And again, with tornadoes, if we just look at the big ones, the F3, F4, F5 tornadoes, it's most likely those we captured, somebody knew about that. So we can take that back to the early 1900s for the really big tornadoes. But in the Doppler era, we see the tornadoes definitely have increased. And we see that severe weather, extreme weather events also, this is UN data I'm talking about, are decreasing. And definitely severe weather-related deaths have just fallen by over 90% since the early 1900s. And we should, these are things that's why they don't have you and me, Will Happer, and the others that are out there talking sense, that they can't have us on, because we provide fascinating, easy understood data that counters this climate crisis narrative.
Well, yeah. I just, speaking of hurricanes, last summer, I believe it was last August of 2023, you had Hurricane Idalia hit Florida, and it was labeled unprecedented, I think, by the National Hurricane Center and also by NPR, CNN. And the reason it was labeled unprecedented, even though at least 46 other U.S. landfalling hurricanes had hit Florida similar, it was the first time a small 50-mile-an-hour stretch of coastline in Florida had been hit by a hurricane when Idalia hit it, like of that strength. So it was unprecedented for where it hit in that 50-mile-an-hour stretch, but absolutely unremarkable in every other aspect for Florida, yet it was labeled unprecedented. How do you fight that kind of scientific nonsense that starts out with our government? Maybe they said it innocently and it was a straight analysis by the U.S. Hurricane Center, but the media picked it up and that was in the headlines. Unprecedented hurricane. It's like saying I had an unprecedented hamburger. Why was it unprecedented? Because I ate it in my closet. I'd never eaten a hamburger in my closet before. How do they get away with that? It's almost the contortions are amazing sometimes.
Yes, they have to jump through these. I just returned from Florida. I spoke Saturday night to a large group there in Apollo Beach, Florida, and I had Florida specific data. I showed landfalling hurricanes going back to 1850 for Florida and showing that they've been in decline. I looked at all the states around rimming the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic to find that only Mississippi of all the states had an increase in landfalling hurricanes. And so they can't let that information out there. It doesn't.
We're out of time. Gregory Wrightstone, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry I had a hard break, but thanks a lot, Gregory. I appreciate it. This is Unleashed with Mark Marano. See you next time.